Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Luke Stoddard Nathan. Today we'll start the show off with a discussion of local events, with me, I guess.
Then Hudson Mohawk Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry takes us to the Underground Railroad History Project LibertyCon 2019 conference.
Afterwards, we'll hear the state of science activism with Cap Size Eli Sands and Elizabeth Fisher.
And later on, an episode of CollarWorks Radio with Justin Baker and Patrick Tyne. Let's start the show off with some headlines.
Governor Andrew Cuomo on Monday, Earth Day, signed a law that bans most single-use plastic bags. The ban goes into effect next year, the Times Union reports.
The Bethesda Episcopal Church in Saratoga is forming a nonprofit organization called the Mercy House of Saratoga to help homeless and others in need. A new four-story building will be built right next to the Bethesda Church. Construction is expected to begin by the end of the year. The church is partnering with other agencies to help not only the homeless, but victims of domestic abuse, those struggling with alcohol and substance abuse, and track backstretch workers in recovery.
The Times Union is teaming up with the Museum of Political Corruption to host an event that will examine potential public policy changes related to ethics. Finding Our Way, Rebuilding Ethics in New York State will be held Wednesday, May 1st at the Times Union's headquarters at 645 Albany Shaker Road. It costs $30 to attend.
The Saratoga Casino Hotel is adding 5 charging stations for electric vehicles as part of its ongoing energy efficiency efforts. Located on Crescent Avenue, the 117-unit hotel expects to open 5 two-port charging stations next month that can charge up to 10 vehicles. Located near the hotel's Jefferson Street entrance, the stations will be free to guests.
The newest Troy City Council member, Deborah Garrett, took an oath of office this afternoon at City Hall. Garrett was appointed by Democrats on the City Council after her District 2 predecessor, Mark McGrath, resigned following the Times Union reporting that he had used racial slurs in a voicemail. Garrett, who is not running for election this year, will serve out the remainder of McGrath's term, which concludes at the end of this year. Garrett has said she wants to use her new platform to help bring extra attention to the North Central neighborhood, which her district includes.
In March, the Capital City Rescue Mission welcomed back Kenomo Nagoran to his home. He was held in ICE custody for 6 weeks, and now he's back in the kitchen for the holidays. Nagoran believed that his time in custody was an eye-opening experience and is grateful for what he learned. Since the Capital City Rescue Mission celebrates Easter with their annual community dinner, he says he couldn't imagine spending the holiday any other way.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/Media Sanctuary. And of course, we're joined by Luke Stoddard Nathan, creator of Troy Letter and my co-host for today.
Well, it's good to be serving in dual roles today. And I can't interview myself, so I will rely on you to ask me questions as necessary. Last week, there was a city council meeting, and there were the one theme that emerged in this city council meeting was that there are a number of sort of committees or sort of advisory kind of committees that are within the city council's purview that have gone that have been sort of lying vacant for quite some time. So the city council took steps toward reviving these defunct committees last week. It appointed 6 members of the public to its Joint Task Force on Sustainability and Climate Smart Practices in Community Planning, You could also just call it a task force on climate change, probably. The members from the community are John Johansson, Katie Tremblay, Michelle Rogat, Gary Nelson, Keani Conley-Wilson, and Steve Libo. The mayor will also be responsible for appointing a chair of this task force and also other members. The main goal, besides just sort of starting to think about the effects of climate change on the city, is trying, the committee's going to be sort of charged with moving the city toward getting a climate smart community status, which is sort of a state designation that recognizes cities that are particularly kind of ahead of the curve in terms of adapting and dealing with climate change. One interesting thing to note that emerged just at this meeting last week is that it seems that the revival of this committee is getting a bit of a chilly reception from the mayor's administration, because I think they're worried about the committee more or less getting in the way of what they're doing.
Right.
The deputy mayor stood up at the end of the meeting and said, while I've been speaking, she was like, I've been working for the city, I think, for 7 years, and we've made a lot of strides, and we're soon going to be entering into an energy savings performance contract, and we're going to be getting these new LED streetlights, among other things. And so all of that's going to keep moving ahead, whether or not the committee, says it's okay. Mm-hmm. That's something to watch. There's nothing new about the sort of the push and pull between the executive branch and the legislative branch in any form of government, but just apparently it's going to be playing out here. So that's something to watch. The administration may be worried that the committee will be a way for the city council to try to take credit where maybe credit's not due.
Right.
And then the other defunct committee that the city council is now taking steps to revive is the Environmental Conservation Commission. I've read over the city code that established this entity so that you don't have to. It was established in the 90s, and the first thing that the city council did last week was change all the mentions of the city manager, which is not a thing. It was the mayor. It was basically like the main executive of the city back, in the 90s, to city council, so that it answers to the city council and not the city manager. It's sort of like it has a more broad ambit. It's kind of like advise the city council, I guess, now on environmental matters and how to protect the environment or whatever. It's probably a more kind of long-term sort of look. The council will need to appoint 8 members to 2-year terms. The thing with these sort of advisory committees is that they tend to sort of fall apart, if they're not held to regular, if they don't have a concrete mission, or if they don't, I don't know. There's probably a lot of different ingredients into whether these sort of volunteer, led, resident led, committees that have some tie to city government, succeed or fail. And for the next Troy letter, just a little preview, I went through the city code, and found, all the different, or at least not all, but I may never be able to find them all, but a lot of the different committees or whatever that have been created over the years that are not currently active. I found at least 6, so I'm going to detail each one, and not to say that they should all be revived, certainly not, but just to kind of, it's just sort of an interesting exercise, I guess.
Do you find that there's some overlap between like the duties where one administration may create a committee, it dies, and then years later they just create another one to do essentially the same function?
I don't know yet. That I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case. I know that there's one entity that I found here. I'm just pulling up my current draft Troy letter. Don't look. And I guess I'll go into this in more detail next time. But there's a Highway Safety Committee, which I had never heard of, which seems pretty similar to the Complete Streets Advisory Group, which still does meet and advises the land use boards about how to make sure that they are kind of thinking about pedestrian safety and stuff when they're approving projects. That seems like a case. I don't know if that was a case of necessarily a new administration being like, I don't like your old way, I'm going to create something identical, as much as it is just a sign of changing best practices or whatever, and changing buzzwords maybe, or changing whatever's, you know, over time. So I don't know. That's something that might may be a fruitful line of further inquiry, or I may just, it may just be a funny list that I put together for next Troy letter, and we can all have a chuckle. Another thing that the City Council's Finance Committee so approved, so this is not yet finalized. This will have to be voted on by the regular, by the council in a regular meeting, probably next month. They kind of made some tweaks to the sale of, to the procedures for selling city-owned property. One of the things is they banned more, or they added more employee, city employees to this class of employees who can't bid on city-owned property without getting council approval first.
Well, they had issues with that recently.
They did. And so it's, and you know, just even if they hadn't had issues, it, that seems like a pretty obvious, like, good anti-corruption measure. So they did that. They are going to allow the Troy Community Land Bank and the Troy Local Development Corporation to acquire city-owned property without kind of competing with other just residents and stuff to bid on it, which, if you consider the Troy Community Land Bank, which I wrote about later in this issue too, you know, if you think about its mission, which is to sort of take properties that are sort of in bad shape and fix them up to some extent and then get them into the hands of a responsible buyer, then, you know, that may make sense to give them sort of a leg up in acquiring city, you know, foreclosed property. And then one other change of note, which I guess is something that's already done but will now be codified, is that when this property review committee, which is sort of a subgroup of the, well, it's made up of city council members and city administration officials, and they're sort of the first step in evaluating proposals to buy city property, that committee is now allowed to consider, or now is supposed to consider, bidder's history of code compliance. Looking at the city code, that may have been something that was already sort of implicitly covered in what they're allowed to evaluate, but now it just sort of makes it more explicit, which again, you know, seems like a good thing if you to something that you would want to consider is whether this person who's buying this property has a history of not complying, say, with code, or you know, giving code, the code enforcement office problems. You know, that might be something that might be a red flag. And then the last thing I'll say, I guess, about this meeting is that the council president, Carmela Mantello, also proposed a change to that same area of city code, although she later tabled it. She was suggesting that the city council be required to approve, or city council approval being required for the release of any of these so-called reverter clauses that the city includes in deeds. These are reverter clauses in the deeds that basically say, if you don't bring this property up to code, or if you don't do what you say you're going to do, then we have the right to take back the property. What usually happens is, I think people don't really think that much about this provision in that deed. And then when they, you know, say 2 years, 5 years, 10 years later, this is how the mayor explained it, go to sell that property and they're in the process of closing, and then the buyer does like some, is trying to get title insurance, or is kind of crossing their I's and dotting their I's and crossing their T's. They realize, oh wow, this provision, that seems bad.
Or
that,
right, that seems like spell trouble. Yeah.
I don't know how I'll get it. You know, that might be some a problem there. So we need to get that released. And so then they appeal to the mayor, and then the mayor's office will send a code enforcement officer out to verify that they've done what they've said they were going to do. If they did, then they, then the paperwork gets kind of eventually ends up at the mayor's desk, and the mayor signs the reverter. And the mayor said that he does this three to five times a month. And again, they have to do it, you know, fairly expediently. Otherwise, the deal might, you know, not go through. And so the mayor pushed back pretty hard on this proposal from Carmela Mantello, because he was like, well, we're going to have to call special meetings all the time just to do this one thing. And it also injects his phrase was an element of uncertainty into the property sale process, because now if the council has to approve this release, it could be, they could maybe decide just, hey, you know what? I don't want to release this. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm keeping this reverter clause. Sorry. You know, it gives the council a discretion that maybe they shouldn't have. And, you know, later, Anasha Cummings also made a similar point, which was like, you know, given that the reverter is supposed to be released as long as the property owner did what they said they were going to do, there is no real room for the city council's spin on it. You know, it's either mm-hmm. they did it or they didn't. So that seems like something that would be best left to the executive branch. Nonetheless, they sort of the mayor's office then sort of as a condition of Mantello tabling the proposal, they agreed to provide the council with a list of reverters that they'd recently released, and a list of properties that were recently sold by the city and their respective compliance with what they had said they were going to do. So that could be interesting information. I hope that is made public at some point, too.
Under that proposal, would the code enforcement officer still be doing the actual inspecting of the building and everything?
Yeah, as far as I know. So it's almost like a format. I don't know what would be the real need of the council to then look at the code enforcement. As long as the code enforcement's doing their job, it's like, do you need the city council being like, yes, I see that you did. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
What would the council's role exactly be?
Right.
Yeah, you know, I guess another set of eyes, and, you know, the council does have, you know, oversight responsibilities, that is it in its purview, but it seems almost like overkill, you know, perhaps.
Right.
Let me talk about the land bank real quick if we have time. The land bank by this Friday is expecting to put out an RFP for the demolition and construction of a building at 791 River Street, and the construction of a new three-story building at that site. This is a site that the city, that the land bank has already spent at least $70,000 on replacing the roof of this property and demolishing part of it. They had wanted to renovate it and kind of make it into a mixed use building, maybe some commercial on the bottom floor, and then the person who bought it could live above it, maybe. You know, and they wanted this to kind of be a flagship product. They wanted to do a kind of contemporary renovation, make it kind of look cool, and be like, hey, North Central, you know, this is something that the land bank is doing. And, you know, this is a sort of different sort of design than your just typical kind of old row house. You know, this is kind of a new spin on things. But after they had contracted that work out, the contractor was in the building and starting to do like preliminary work and was just like, oh, wow, this building is way less stable than we thought it was. Mm-hmm. The brick on the inside, I guess, was sort of just disintegrating. The contractor said, we don't feel safe doing this. And so the land bank went back to the drawing board and said, well, fine, we'll just demolish the building and then build something new. And so they just got back the latest design that I included in the Troy letter, which looks contemporary.
Very modern.
This is Capital Architecture of Cohoes that did the renderings. One board member hated it, Suzanne Spellen, who, interestingly enough, is also on the Planning Commission, although presumably she would have to recuse herself when this comes before the Planning Commission. And lucky for the land bank that she'll have to recuse herself because she might even though she's on the land bank board, might not vote to approve it, given how she really doesn't like how it looks and doesn't think it really fits with the neighborhood. This is at,
I should sort of
say,
have
too,
to agree.
This is 791 River Street, so this is not far from here. I personally sort of, dare I say, like it. I think it's sort of weird and different, and, you know, kind of is like, sure, why not try something new, like,
right.
You know, there, it uses concrete in a way, in a kind of different way, and it has a back deck, and I think they're gonna go for, I don't know, it's not everybody's cup of tea, but I can respect the attempt, even if I'm not sure about the amount of, I mean, they're gonna spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on this project. You know, land bank exists to sort of help the neighborhood. It has limits on what it like rents that the buyers can eventually charge. You know, it's supposed to be for neighborhood stabilization. I don't know if this is maybe over, but I think they're trying to keep prices as low as they can, cost as low as they can. Mm-hmm. And they think they're not going to make a profit on it. They're going to probably sell it for, they guessed, you know, around $220,000. Mm-hmm. That's really sort of an estimate, but that was floated at the meeting that I was at. So I guess we'll wait and see if they actually put this out to bid, whether you know, potential contractors can build it, for a decent amount of money. Mm-hmm. And then whether there's a market for it. They think there is. I don't, you know, I'm not in the market to buy a home, but I guess if I was, I would consider it. So I don't know, something to,
yeah,
if you're interested, keep monitoring it. Yeah. Another thing that is in the pipeline is another charrette. Don't we all love charrettes? These are design workshops where, you know, a planning firm will, you know, bring together a group of people and then, you know, have a lot of whiteboards and things and ask you what, you know, what you want to see or what you, whatever you want to vision. And then you eventually arrive at a design. The downtown bid and the Troy Capital Resource Corporation, which is a non-profit-y kind of thing that the city basically controls, have each committed $15,000 to a design charrette for a playground downtown that would likely be sited in Riverfront Park. Okay. The charrette's going to be led by Adirondack Studios, which if you look at their website, it's linked in the in my Troy letter. It's sort of fairly colorful designs, kind of like almost the deputy mayor even, and I don't think she meant this necessarily as a pejorative, but she described their designs, at least the renderings that Adirondack Studios have already provided the bid of, like, concepts, you know, which I haven't seen, but I would love to. She described the designs as very theme parkish, and she said that, you know, they might not really fit with Riverfront Park, you know, which is right now sort of like fairly plain park, there's some, you know, monuments and stuff in there. There's that like amphitheater kind of thing where concerts are sometimes, but it's pretty plain. But you know, the bid talked about at their meeting last week, how they want it to be a destination playground. Like they want it to really be something that brings people from out of town to the playground and brings, you know, and actually gets used also by people who live here, you know. So it needs to be not just like, they're not talking about just like put up some monkey bars or something. Like they want like something
apparently vaguely fairly, theme parkish,
vaguely theme parkish perhaps, which I think I get. I don't know. I don't know how much it's going to cost. They had said in the city's application for the Downtown Revitalization Initiative last year, big, you know, multi-million dollar state grant for, you know, a lot of projects in a downtown area, which the city lost. They had estimated that a project of this type would cost $500,000.
Oh, wow.
You know, I guess also I'm biased, I should say, since I have a baby now. So I, you know, I'm like, where's my baby going to, well, not baby, but where will my baby once she is grown, you know, go play? There's not really a compelling playground downtown. There's one on 3rd Street next to the frat. Between the frat and Barker Park, but it's like kind of just like squeezed into a little yard. Like it's not really that great. You know, there's the splash pad that's at Riverfront Park already. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe the playground would make a nice companion thing to that, but you know, and if it comes from state funds, you know, maybe there will be less pushback from the public here. You know, if there might be people who might question whether the city should, you know, which it's not, but if it were to, the city were to try to spend $500,000 on a playground, I wonder how that would go. Although, there was a lot of support for rehabilitating the pools, which are sort of
in
the same line. So maybe there would be support for that too. So I don't know where the money is going to come from at this point, but the respective stakeholders are interested in getting a design that the public supports. So keep an eye out for that for when the charrette is. I'd imagine it will be open to the public.
Awesome. And since we're running low on time, why don't you take a second and tell people where they can stay up to date on all things Troy?
tinyletter.com/Troy_letter, or you can just email me luke.s.nathan@gmail.com and say, please give me Troy Letter. I want that. And I'll sign you up.
And your Patreon?
Oh, and I have a Patreon too, patreon.com/Troy Letter, where I solicit support for my thing. All right. To keep it operating.
The Hudson Mohawk Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended the Underground Railroad History Project LibertyCon 2019 conference Seeking Sanctuary, Life, Liberty, Pursuit of Happiness at Siena College on March 29th and 31st of 2019. This is part five of a five-part segment where he recorded highlights from the conference. Here you'll hear his interview with Frank Wicks, former professor at Union College and RPI, about a project to put a statue of William Seward and Harriet Tubman at the Schenectady County Library.
This is Willie Terry, your labor correspondent for WOOC radio station, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm here at the Underground Railroad Conference. It's on a Saturday, March the 30th, and I'm here with Frank Wicks. Sitting at a table with a lot of pictures and little statues of Harriet Tubman and William Seward. And I'm going to ask him, you know, what it's all about. How you doing, Frank?
Very good. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you.
Oh, okay. No problem, Frank. Frank, now, just tell me something about this table first. You know, these pictures and stuff you got up here. Where did all these pictures come from?
We've taken this pic. We have a project to its... It's a publicity pictures for the statue we're building.
Oh, okay, for the statue.
So the end purpose is to have a statue of Harriet Tubman and William Seward at the Schenectady Public Library. And there's many statues of Harriet Tubman. There's many statues of William Seward, but this is going to be the only statue that has the two of them together. Seward was an important person. He was a New York State Senator, New York State Governor, United States Senator, and Secretary of State during the Civil Wars.
In New York State?
Bought Alaska.
Mm-hmm. In New York State?
No, United States Secretary of State.
Oh, United State, okay.
And he almost died with Lincoln during the Lincoln assassination. He survived and bought Alaska.
How was that? He was there with Lincoln?
He was attacked. Seward was the conspiracy to kill Lincoln was also to kill Seward. Oh. Lincoln died. Seward just barely survived.
And he got shot the same day.
Yeah, he got stabbed with a knife.
Oh, stabbed with a knife.
Yeah,
oh.
Right. Some bad face wounds.
Oh, well, that's the piece of
so he almost died. His son almost died. His wife died of the trauma. He recovered. He was able to get the 13th Amendment passed. The 13th Amendment, the one that banned slavery, it had been approved by the Congress, but not by the states. Mm-hmm. Then he stayed on and he purchased Alaska from the Russians. Mm-hmm. Then he traveled around the world and wrote about it. Mm-hmm. So, and Seward also went to Union College in Schenectady, class of 1820. Separately, he met Harriet Tubman.
Right.
Harriet Tubman was leading a Underground Railroad. Seward's home was a sanctuary. So before the Civil War, they got to know each other. Seward provided Harriet Tubman with a nearby home. She lived there for the next 54 years. Both Seward and Tubman are born and buried in the same cemetery.
Is that Auburn, New York?
Auburn, in the Fort Hill Cemetery in Auburn.
Right, okay.
We have an inscription for the model, and the inscription has the William Seward and Harriet Tubman. We got lucky because each one has the same number of letters in the first name and last name, so it gives a nice balance. But we show that Seward was born in 1801, Tubman was born 20 years later. But they both lived during the Civil War. And the theme here is leaders, freedom, diversity, and friendship. This is the purpose of statue with a story and with a message. Now, we also have by the people, for the people. Mm-hmm. People might recognize that's from Lincoln's Gettysburg Address.
And this is going to be on the statue?
Yeah, that's going to be the inscription on the statue. Seward went to Gettysburg with Lincoln and reviewed the address before it. Mm-hmm. So we took those words from the Gettysburg Address. Because this statue is by the people, for the people, we have more than 100 donors right now. a statue is done in parts. First, you got to build the model. Mm-hmm. So you make the model out of clay. Mm-hmm. So here's a clay model of William Seward and Harriet Tubman. Tubman, as the Moses of her people, has a shepherd's staff.
Now, who's that making this statue?
This is Dexter Benedict, who's a professor at Keokuk College, mm-hmm. but also has a... So he's a... Sculptor, but he also has a foundry.
Right.
So there's two parts of making a statue. One is to make the clay model of it and get it approved. And then finally, you got to convert this into bronze. That's a craft. The way you convert that into bronze is you can't pour the bronze all at once. You cut it into pieces. You cut off the head, you cut off the arms, you cut off the body, a number of small pieces. And then you put plastic around those pieces, and then you pour in wax. Mm-hmm. And then just at the right temperature, you got to boil off the... Then you get the bronze at 2,000 degrees. You put that in the mold, and the wax evaporates. And what you got left is the bronze pieces. Then you got to put those bronze pieces back together again.
So is the statue... already done? It's just waiting for the ceremony?
He's in the final part of it.
Oh, he's in the final part.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, you also need... We have an inscription on it, which is... that's going to be the inscription on the bottom.
At the bottom.
Mm-hmm. And separately, we need a pedestal.
Right.
We took that pedestal from a quarry along the Mohawk River. Mm-hmm. So both Seward and Tubman and their... You know, for different reasons, traveled the Mohawk Valley. That piece of stone is 350 million years old.
Mm.
It's a limestone. So this is a level of, here's a species that lived 350 million years ago at that level. So we're not going to cut anymore. That's going to be in front of the Schenectady Museum.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said it's going to be in front of this?
Yes.
No, where would the statue be? At the library?
I'm sorry, not the Schenectady Library, public library.
Right. It's going to be in the front of the library?
There's two doors.
Uh-huh.
So it's going to be in the door that comes in from the from the parking lot.
From the parking lot?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So if you're in the library, you can either go left or right.
Now, there's a committee that's working on this?
Yeah.
And you're part of the committee?
I initiated it.
Oh, you initiated it?
So it takes a commitment. It's important to get someone with a sculptor that also has a foundry.
Right.
And they're almost non-existent. Mm-hmm. So when you have the opportunity, you got to go for it.
Yeah.
So to make it happen... The price $62,000. I guaranteed the $62,000 to get it going.
Right. Tell me something about yourself, though. What are you? Are you a teacher?
I've been living in Schenectady for 57 years. Mm-hmm. I was a General Electric engineer.
Right.
I was a professor at RPI in Troy, and I've been a professor at Union College for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And my interest here is William Seward. Graduated from Union College in 1820.
Mm-hmm.
His wife graduated from Emma Willard in Troy in 1820.
Mm-hmm.
His Seward's sister graduated from Emma Willard in Troy in 1820. So they're all from this area.
Mm-hmm.
And those. Later on, they lived in
Boston. Were you a history teacher?
Engineer.
Oh, you're engineering.
Engineer.
But you did study some history.
Yeah, I pay attention.
Did Harriet Tubman ever visit Skinner?
She visited Troy. She freed Charles there.
Right.
At the end of the day, after freeing Charles, they got to get over the river to Water of Leet, was then West Troy.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got Charles into Schenectady and put him on an Erie Canal barge going west. So there's not a record that she went everywhere, but she couldn't go from Troy to Auburn to Syracuse. Yeah, everything had to go through Schenectady.
Had to go through. Yeah. Okay.
You can't get there without going through Schenectady.
I got you. It had to go through Schenectady. And so Troy had the Nall case, but we don't have a statue in Troy. We have a little monument.
A monument, a building.
And something in Waterville about Nall. right? Yeah. The McDonald's, but it's not a statue.
Yeah.
So Schenectady would be the first place in the capital district to have an actual statue.
There's three firsts for Schenectady.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be the first statue of Sword.
Right, of Sword.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be the first statue of Harry Tubman.
Right.
It's going to be the first statue of a woman.
Right.
So we got three for two. We got three with two people. We got three first.
And what date is this going to happen on now?
It's going to happen on, I'm sorry,
May
17, mm-hmm. 11 o'clock in the morning. We have a program in the Schenectady Library with talks and music, mm-hmm. and video, and then with if people that are knowledgeable. And then at noon with television stations and you. You're going to be there,
right,
we hope. We're going to go out there, and then we'll get the important people to cut the ribbon.
Right. Oh, okay. I got you.
And this is going to get a lot of attention.
Right.
It has a web page here.
Mm-hmm.
The web page is Tubman Seward Statue .org.
It was Frank Wick.
Yeah.
Who's working on a statue of Harriet Tubman and William Sear to be dedicated on May 17, 2019 at 11 a.m. to noon, the unveiling, at the Schenectady County Public Library. And that's located at 99 Clinton Street in Schenectady. And if you need more information, go to info@tubmanseward.org. SEWARDS statue.org. Come out on a Friday, May 17th, to see the unveiling of this. Thank you.
That was the final part of a series of segments recorded by Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry at the Underground Railroad History Project's LibertyCon 2019 conference. Head of CAPSCI, an organization promoting science and science activism in the Capital Region, Eli Sands sits down with Liz Fisher of the Neural Stem Cell Institute in Rensselaer. Liz spoke at the April 13th State of Science panel, which was coordinated by CAPSCI at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
Hi, my name is Eli Sands. I'm vice president of CAPSCI. Our organization promotes science and science activism in the Capital Region. And I'm here today interviewing one of our members, Liz Fisher. Liz, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, sort of where you're from and what you're doing here in the Capital Region?
Okay, so my name is Liz Fisher. I'm originally from Charlotte, North Carolina, and grew up there and went to undergrad in Asheville, North Carolina, where I really got interested in science as a career, which brought me to grad school in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which roundabout way led me to Texas to finish off my PhD in biomedical science field. And I finished my PhD in the summer of 2017 and moved up here to do a postdoctoral fellowship researching spinal cord injury at the Neural Stem Cell Institute in Rensselaer.
Wow. So that's amazing. So I guess my first question for you, as even though I know you, maybe you could give me a little bit more in depth about why you joined CAPSCI.
I joined CAPSCI pretty soon after I moved up here. I was really interested in continuing science outreach work. I had done a significant amount of science outreach when I was in San Antonio. I was working with fellow grad students, and we put on an event called Science Fiesta, which was bringing together a big group of a bunch of different groups to promote different kinds of science in ways that we thought work well with families, because San Antonio is kind of a economically disadvantaged city and there isn't a lot of access to information. And Fiesta is this huge event in San Antonio. It's a week and a half of basically like block parties all over town. So we wanted to have a science fiesta where we like reached out to the community about the science that was going on in San Antonio. And we also brought in health groups to help promote health screenings and things like that at Science Fiesta. So I found CAPSCI through Science on Tap events that we also promote. I think I went to one and wanted to plug in up here to continue my science outreach and advocacy work.
What do you think are some of the most important issues that CAPSCI should be addressing in the Capital Region in terms of its outreach and advocacy?
So I always think it's important to make sure we're reaching all communities in ways that, you know, I think in science we just kind of assume and take things for granted, like, oh yeah, everybody has to know this piece of information. Everybody knows that, you know, the Earth is round, but maybe people don't. So there is, I also have been really interested in working with children and getting children excited about science early and cultivating that interest in science. So I think through outreach activities that we do, such as the panel that we did today, but also Meet a Scientist, where we've gone out to places like MySci and introduced children to real scientists so that they're like, oh, these are real people, and they're not, you know, very intimidating or anything like that, and making sure that, you know, children can see themselves as scientists, as, you know, as much as anything else.
Speaking of our panel today, we'll ask one sort of last question. Listening today, there's a lot of sort of great advice and great thought about science activism and where it can go and what's important to really, what's important for us as citizens to do. Is there something that you sort of took from it that you want to bring into the community or something you want to work on?
I think it's speaking more upfront about what you know and not being afraid to be a science activist. I think Abby was talking about being bold and making sure that, you know, you can speak up about your science and not necessarily be fearful that people will see you as being, you know, biased in what you do, because I'm very passionate about science. I'm very passionate about what I do in my work, but I also, you know, don't necessarily, I'm not as vocal about it as I should be sometimes. And I think maybe this would inspire me to be more vocal about things that I am knowledgeable about.
What is your field of research specifically right now as a postdoc?
So I currently work on spinal cord injury, and I work on how the immune system influences spinal cord injury. So how the immune system can make spinal cord injury worse and how we can modulate that effect. However, I also work at a stem cell institute, and stem cells tend to be sometimes a controversial issue. And my scientific mentor has been really active in talking about stem cells in general as treatments, as therapies. So she gave a great talk when I at a symposium at Harvard that I watched her give a couple months ago. And so I actually signed up to do a Science on Tap talking about something similar, because long story short, I was talking with my mother. She texted me randomly out of the blue. She has a friend who is unfortunately suffering kidney disease and only has 5% of her kidney functions. And she went to some seminar that was promoting this totally bogus therapy of stem cells. So there are these stem cell clinics that hawk stem cells as treatments for absolutely any disease ever. And the reality is there are no FDA-approved treatments for stem cell therapies at all. And there are clinics all over the country, there are some even in the Capital District, that are doing these things that aren't, sometimes they are illegal, but sometimes they aren't technically illegal, but they're not actually approved. And people will pay thousands of dollars to have these things done when it's not actually an approved treatment.
That's buck wild. That's crazy. So what, in terms then, what do you hope, I guess my question then for you then is, like, are you hoping that your research will lead to treatments
Definitely. I mean, I think all people who work in their field want to, well, not all, but not every scientist is working towards cures, but especially what I'm doing where I work, we are hoping to, you know, have treatments for diseases, but the problem is that the science, for the most part, isn't there yet. We haven't gone through those clinical trials that would determine whether or not these treatments are effective, but there are loopholes in the laws that allow these clinics to somewhat function, and they promote themselves as being cures for diseases when they're not actually. And so, anyway, and it spiraled, and the FDA can't really keep up with the number of these clinics because the FDA is kind of underfunded in this area. And so, they can't always keep up. They can't shut everyone down. There's hundreds across the U.S. And so they can't really go after all of them at once. And so I think educating the public about what is known information and what isn't known information, it would be really helpful. And I think that's something that I can do because I know what the science is.
Very cool. All right. So I think I have time for one more question this time. And I guess my question is, maybe we'll pick something a little bit more general, a little more fun. What's sort of your favorite science myth? Like, what's the one thing that you hear that you're like, this is totally ridiculous, totally wild, and why and how would you go about like trying to explain to someone that believes in it that what they're thinking is just faulty, but in a non-contemptuous way?
That is so general that I am lost for an answer. Favorite science myth?
I know, right?
Don't worry about the time.
I think...
like, what's something that's like... Like, for me, I think my favorite science myth is the specific flat earth theory that we're in a dome, that we're in like a sorry trouble, like we're dice just in like a clicker clack dome. And the idea of that to me is just so bonkers that I almost want to be true. And like this, like, we live in like in some sort of board game like scenario. And so I guess for me is like, is there something that you just think about and you're like, you just think about the logical extent of what they're thinking and you're like, that's just crazy.
Okay, this may not exactly be what you're looking for, but I think my favorite science myth is that scientists themselves are these mysterious people living in these ivory towers that like, we just don't know how to get out of our holes and we live in this bubble and we, you know, don't know how to talk to people and interact with people and that we're all, I guess, like the Big Bang Theory. I don't know. So
you're not all living a life in 30-minute episodes. And
Right. And I think that, you know, maybe we're not all the best at talking to people. That's fair. But I think that we're just people that have dedicated our lives to something we're passionate about, and everybody does that. It's just we've decided to dedicate our lives to some very, very specific scientific question that maybe isn't something that anyone else has thought about, but I don't think that inherently we're like that much different than anyone else. I think that it's a myth that scientists are like these just crazy people that can't relate to other people, right? Like that scientists aren't.
But you're not, you know, that scientists are living next door to you and they're not this inaccessible human being.
Right.
That like, doesn't have problems like taking out the trash.
Right.
But I think we have just reached our end of our official time for this interview. Thank you so much, Liz, for sitting down with me and having a quick chat.
Thank you, Eli.
That was Eli Sands of CAPSCI speaking with Liz Fisher of the Neural STEM Institute in Rensselaer.
CollarWorks radio host Justin Baker interviews guest Patrick Tyne, new arts contributor for the Times Union, about his recent trip to Hudson, New York, exploring the gallery scene down the river and what is boutique custom-made shampoo.
Hey everybody, this is Collarworks Radio. I'm your host, Justin Baker, and with me this week is Patrick Tyne, a new arts contributor to the TU. How are you doing, Patrick?
Doing very well. How are you?
Good. Excellent. Have you on here this week. If you could give us a little idea maybe about what's going on in the region and things that you could check out in Hudson.
Wonderful. Well, I just got back from a weekend in Hudson. It was the most Hudson weekend you could possibly imagine. I went to a store where they custom make your own shampoo and conditioner. Don't ask me how much that cost, but my partner insisted on it, and now I have custom-made shampoo and conditioner.
You have the shampoo?
I do, and conditioner. It's got frankincense in it.
Oh, okay. It's very Catholic.
It's extraordinary. Well, you know, Holy Week. So I saw a couple of things. You know, walking down Warren Street in Hudson is one of the great pleasures of living in upstate New York. And I was drawn in to one gallery in particular, and that was the Hudson Milliner Art Salon, which is showing the work of Charlotta Johnson, who is a German artist. The show is called Americana, Celebrating Our Checkered Past and Present. And it's a series of paintings, collage-type pieces of basically, you know, rebellious heroes in American history. So you have a great shot of Rosa Parks. There's a huge seven-panel collage homage to a picture of Harlem taken by the legendary African-American photographer James Van Der Zee, which is selling for a lot, but well worth it. My personal favorite was a piece she did of the Reverend William Sloan Coffin, who was a great anti-war Presbyterian leader, and she's interspersed pieces of a firebrand speech he gave against the war, and it's extraordinarily moving, and you know, he was a great, you know, it always bothers me that somehow the religion is ceded to the middle of the country or to the South, because there's nothing like invective delivered in such a New York accent like his was. And it's really beautiful stuff. And she really took the time to talk to me about, you know, how much she enjoys chronicling this country for better or for worse, and mentioned an interesting story that she briefly was the landlady for Sasha Frere Jones, who was a music critic for the New Yorker, and one of the people that made it was an influence to me as a critic, as a person who wanted to take criticism seriously rather than just being a guy.
And this is the artist?
This is the artist. She was there. She was there and literally, you know, put her phone on silent, you know, to continue talking to me. I was extremely flattered. And she also was handing out postcards addressed to Reality Winner, who is currently she's been prosecuted for whistleblowing, and there was some mistakes made by The Intercept in you know, redacting documents, and she was kind of hung out to dry.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
And she has a painting of Reality Winner too, and hopefully if that sells, Reality will get some when she gets out of prison. So anyway, it was great. I love political stuff. I haven't been able to write about it yet, you know, so it was great to see. And I really enjoyed it. It was really powerful.
What was the name of the gallery again, just for the listeners?
It was the Hudson Milliner Art Salon. I gather it is also a bit of a bed and breakfast and a restaurant.
Okay.
As a bit of everything. Many of those places. Yeah, there. Yeah. Yes. So that was really cool.
Okay.
Loved it. It was a really good space.
Warren was this, like, middle, upper,
it
lower?
It was kind of middle. I mean, you Google it, you'll see it. It's the... if you're facing the river, it's on the left-hand side of the street.
Okay, cool.
So then, you know, I walked in, saw a lot of other stuff. But the thing that really caught my eye was at the venerable Kerry Haddad Gallery.
Sure.
One of the, I think maybe the oldest gallery in Hudson. Longest.
Yeah.
So there was an artist named Jenny Nelson who had some really very perfect for the time and the weather, you know, light abstract pieces. But what really got me were... these pieces by an artist named Andrea Moreau, and she works in the most interesting medium I've seen in quite some time, which is the postage stamp.
She takes
postage stamps from different countries. There was one from Czechoslovakia. There was a particularly interesting one from Mongolia, and then creates these elaborate scenes around them, like the one from Mongolia from the 70s. It was a Soviet republic, and so it was proclaiming their space program. There's this little Mars rover, and from that she just created the surface of Mars. It was really great. And there was a stamp of some hated ruler of Czechoslovakia
It's probably a lot of those.
A lot of them. And I tried to look it up and I couldn't find it and I didn't have a picture of it. But anyway, his face, he was behind the counter at a butcher shop. Oh, and okay. I thought that was just twisting the knife. Hilarious.
Oh, that's great.
Wry, wonderful. You know, I'm not really into stamp collecting, but I would be into Andrea Moreau collecting because that was just wonderful. There was also, they had some...
So just to get it straight in my mind, she has the stamp and then she paints around
it. She kind of paints around it, but it kind of, the image bursts forth from the stamp. And on some of them, you don't realize it's a stamp. You just think it's like a drawing of a person. Then you look and you see like the price on it.
Oh, that's clever. Yeah.
And it is very clever. I mean, it's the kind of thing that is, you know, not all this has to be difficult. You know what I mean?
Right, right. Yeah.
Some of it is just fun and, but with an edge. And I just love stuff like that. And it was just a pleasure to see. There were also some interesting cyanotypes. From Bridget Blythe, who I'm not that familiar with, but her idea was she took legacy media like CD cases and magnetic tape from tape cassettes and put them on the cyanotype. So it's like you have this ancient, you have this legacy medium of the cyanotype and this legacy media, and it was a cool little commentary. And they're interesting.
So the two are collaged together.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah. Well, she's the imprint she's making on the cyan paper. Are the CD cases or the thing? So it's just like it's a little riff. It was, and I love that gallery. And I'd never met Carrie Haddad, and she was very happy. She was a wonderful. You know, if you ever get a chance, she's very polite and very fun and friendly.
I think I may have talked to her once. Yeah.
And she said, "What do you do?" And I said, "I write for the Times Union." She said, "What? I write for the Times Union." I go, "Okay."
Okay.
But she was nice. She was really nice about it.
Yeah.
So those are the two really cool things that I saw. But it's, some of this stuff might be going fast. Mm-hmm. So if that might not be there by the time this is out, but you can look up these artists and they do have certain followings and you'll be able to find their work elsewhere.
Right. Well, you know, even if this show's down, which we pray it's not, but you know, Hudson's just fun in general to walk around, and there's, yeah, we were mentioning two galleries. There's probably, I don't know,
dozens.
30 more. Yeah.
And then, you know, and they're, and at every price point, I mean, you know, that some of the stuff you go in there and it's like, oh, that's just, you know, that chair costs as much as a Honda Civic, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Do it. And there's so much good furniture. I mean, every time I go there, I think I gotta move here. You know?
Right. Yeah.
One of these days.
Yeah.
So that was good.
So go to Hudson, check it out, and have some fun. Maybe look at furniture. Well, thank you, Patrick, for being here. A couple things that I wanted to just point out that people should go see. Locally, Collarworks Gallery, we have the 41st Photo Regional up till April 27th, and then Everyday Perfection at the Albany International Airport. Great show based on Shaker artifacts and collections with contemporary artists kind of doing their thing. Patrick, did you have anything you wanted to throw out there?
Oh,
for
sure.
Us?
Yeah. If you want to find me, you can find me on the Times Union. Just Google my name, Times Union. My articles will come up, and you can find me on Twitter at TheRealPDT. Help me in my struggle to get followed by Richard Prince.
Excellent. Okay. We will do that. Again, thank you, Patrick, and get down to Hudson if you can. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Collarworks Radio host Justin Baker interviewing Patrick Tyne, a new arts contributor for the Times Union.
That concludes our show. Can you believe it? We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Luke Stoddard-Nathan.
And I'm Eric Newton. Our engineer tonight is Amy Loria. Remember to tune in back tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
I'm glad that people are taking their tender confessions through the official channel and not to, don't send that to me. As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org, not .com.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thank you for tuning in.